From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the trials and tribulations of death. Now, for most states, by the way, daylight saving time Sunday at 2 a.m. Turn your clocks ahead 1 hour. Don't forget, Hawaii and Arizona do not honor DST. Here's what's happening. Wall Street resumed its slide on Thursday, ending in the red as inflation hit a four-decade high, cementing expectations that the U.S. Federal Reserve would hike key interest rates at its conclusion of next week's monetary policy meeting to prevent the economy from overheating. Looming uncertainty surrounding Russia's invasion of Ukraine also helped convince market participants to recommence their flight to safety. Financial woes coupled with a barrage of horrifying scenes from Ukraine as Russia continues its invasion have pushed a majority of Americans to unprecedented levels of stress, according to a new report from the American Psychological Association. The association's annual Stress in America poll found that U.S. adults already weary from 2 years of COVID-19 pandemic are now overwhelmingly troubled by inflation and the war in Ukraine. According to the results, 87% of those surveys cited rising costs of everyday items such as groceries and gasoline as a significant source of their stress. President Joe Biden's administration will extend requirements for travelers to wear masks on airplanes, trains, and in transit hubs through now April 18 as public health officials and authorities review when mask requirements should be dropped. The move extends the current requirements that were set to expire March 19th by a month. And the World Health Organization has confirmed that the new variant, dubbed Deltacron, a combination of Delta and Omicron, has been detected in France, Denmark, and the Netherlands. What does this all mean? Let's check in with Christian Wild from MyHeartBook.com. Christian, here we go again.
Here we go again, George. Just when we thought it was safe to get back in the water. You know, the Nuri family, the Radio Nuri family, has to be thrilled at the falling number of COVID cases and subsequent deaths that are being documented in the United States, even though cases in countries like Japan and Hong Kong have literally gone off the rails to the degree, George, that hospitals are reporting being unable to keep up with the dying. Now, that's what you have on one side. Thankfully, here in the United States, things are looking better. But according to many experts in infectious disease, professionals who spend their careers studying outbreaks like COVID and the variants and mutations that by reinventing themselves continue to prolong the original viral pandemic. These pros continue to urge us to be cautious. And several have told us in no uncertain terms that this pandemic is far from over. Now, all the while, and even as current as last week, several of these experts have told us that even though the recent numbers are encouraging, we still have a long way to go before we declare victory. The advice and phrases that they issue are not so fast, and this is no time to get cocky. George, about a year ago, we talked about a highly contagious and transmittable variant that within 1 month had become the dominant variant in the world, spreading twice as quickly as the original Delta. It was named Omicron. You might recall, George, how quickly it spread to 89 countries as if overnight. Well, like many of you yesterday, we awoke to see a headline focusing on a new variant that has been discovered a month ago, but has now become a mutation of concern. It's been named Deltacron and is a combination of both Delta and Omicron. This variant was discovered first in Cyprus. It is now being found in many other countries. So the beat goes on, and according to the professor of biological sciences at the University of Cyprus, he's also head of the Laboratory of Biotechnology, made this announcement. We will see in the very near future if this strain is even more pathological or more contagious, or will it actually prevail over Delta and Omicron. And George, in the meantime, maybe we should take the experts' advice to keep our guard up for ourselves and our families in our day-to-day and stay safe.
Vitamin C, zinc, D3, and turmeric every day. That's what I take.
It's blocking the virus.
You got it. Thanks, Christian. Appreciate it. Listening to music really does chill people out, a new study reveals. A team from Ryerson University in Canada says treatments integrating music and auditory beat stimulation are particularly effective in reducing anxiety in some patients. They say the auditory beat stimulation involves combinations of tones played in one or both ears designed to trigger changes to brain activity. Studies show cases of anxiety have been steadily increasing, particularly among teenagers and young adults over recent decades. Virgin Orbit, Richard Branson's company, is targeting this summer for the first ever orbital launch from the United Kingdom soil. Amazing. The California-based company has three straight successful orbital missions already under its belt. Kevin Randall, he's got his weekly UFO report for us. What do you have there, sir?
Hey, good evening, George.
Hi, Kev.
Just yesterday, I came across a website that I won't name, claiming recently declassified pictures proved the Roswell crash was real. The pictures were not of an alien spacecraft, as they claimed, but a crashed remains of an A-12 spy plane. The pictures came from the National Geographic site and were labeled as exclusive Area 51 pictures, secret plane crash revealed, and were posted to the site on May 21st, 2011. National Geographic noted that the crash happened in 1963 in Utah and that the pictures had been declassified by the CIA more than a decade ago. And I'll post a link to the January analysis of this on my blog. Continuing in this vein, John Greenwald of Black Vault fame has managed, through the Freedom of Information Act, to obtain a copy of the 19-page report that was sent to Congress about UAPs. This is a more comprehensive version than the one that was released last June. Well, it tells us nothing. It is nearly completely redacted with only a few words on the first page that have not been edited out. It's not unlike that document that Stan Friedman used to show that was nearly blank, though we now know that that document was dealing with intelligence gathering rather than UFO sightings.
Right.
In this case, we know that it deals with UFOs, and as they call them, UAPs, because that was the purpose of the report. But rather than transparency, we have a document that is dark as the inside of a cave. There's no real hint about what was seen, who saw what, or anything to do with evidence. As I've said, this doesn't suggest that we are moving toward disclosure. Instead, we are retreating to the same situation we've endured for about 70 years. That doesn't mean there aren't some interesting sightings. Just 9 days ago, a witness in Pacific, Missouri, reported a single craft that was flying low and slow. At first, it seemed to be a flock of birds, but it soon became clear it was a triangular-shaped craft that had lights all around it. The UFO continued to glide off and was beginning a slight climb. The witness attempted to photograph the UFO, but there was nothing to be seen on the picture. The UFO was in sight for about a minute. Another triangle was seen in Johnson Valley, California, on February 22nd of this year. The witness said that a bright white light that looked at first like a planet or star continued to approach, growing bigger until it took up a large portion of the sky. It seemed to jump or teleport from one part of the sky to another. The shape was that of a triangle that was emitting an orange light. I'll note here, orange light or lights are frequently reported with this sort of craft. The UFO was in sight for 2 to 3 minutes, and the witness reported no fear and thought of this as a casual observation. Keeping with this trend of triangular craft and orange light, there was a report from Wachula, Florida, on February 19th of this year. According to the witness, it was triangular-shaped at first and appeared to transform into another shape. There was no sound associated with the object, but interestingly, there were aircraft in the area that seemed to be chasing the UFO. The witness watched for about 10 minutes as the formation, that is, the UFOs and the aircraft, flew toward the south. On February 15th, the witness in Smicksburg, Pennsylvania, reported three lights in a triangular formation that was in sight for about 2 minutes. The witness stopped, got out of the car to take pictures of the UFO. It was slow moving, made no sound, and I'll post pictures of it to my blog. And that's what I have for tonight, George.
All right, Kev, we'll talk to you next week. In a moment, Ben Mezrich back with us, noted author, of course. This time a blockbuster called The Midnight Ride, but we're also going to talk with him about his work called Once Upon a Time in Russia, The Rise of the Oligarchs, a true story of ambition, wealth, betrayal, and murder. Wait till you hear this next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Ben Mezrich back with us. He's got a great book out called The Midnight Ride, the reigning champion of narrative nonfiction with a writing career spanning at least 19 years. Ben has authored 24 books. The genre he's created, cinematic and unique true stories of young geniuses battling their way through the gray area between right and wrong and succeeding at all costs. These include the wildly successful Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for millions. That was adapted into a hit motion picture, 21, you might remember that. The Accidental Billionaires, that was adapted into a hit movie called The Social Network. And The Midnight Ride, which you just wrote, is going to also be a movie that's already been optioned off, hasn't it, Ben?
Yes, it has. Actually, Steven Spielberg bought the rights. So.
Good for you.
It's kind of exciting, yeah.
And we're going to talk about this book in a moment, but it combines, it's fiction, but it combines a real story, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It goes to a real story that I've been fascinated by for a long time, so yes.
You wrote a book called Once Upon a Time in Russia, and it's so timely because of what's going on now in Ukraine. Let's talk about these oligarchs. What are Russian oligarchs anyway?
Sure. So the Russian oligarchs were a group of men who came to vast wealth and power in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed and became capitalistic. Boris Yeltsin was the head of Russia at the time, and he handed Russia's resources off to a group of men. One of them would get the aluminum industry, one of them would get the oil industry, one of them would get the banking or the media. And these people, and they were mostly black marketeers, they were outsiders, they were all really young men at the time who were businessmen but not part of any kind of profession. And they were found because actually Yeltsin's daughter, Tatiana, was a legendary party girl in Moscow, and she would bring her friends to her father, who would handpick these guys and then hand them industries. So they grew to...
Just basically gave it to them? I mean, did they have any cash involved?
There was cash, but it was these weird deals where they would basically borrow the cash that they would then use to pay for a business that Yeltsin would okay. If Yeltsin didn't okay it, they couldn't take it over. So essentially, they didn't really have any money to start with, and they were just handed these resources. It was very corrupt. It was this crony form of capitalism. And the reason Yeltsin did it was because he didn't understand capitalism. He didn't know how it worked, and he was trying to fight against communism. So he thought the quickest way to jumpstart things was to hand over these resources to people he considered businessmen.
And
really, they just took over Russia.
Were most of these oligarchs opposed to Vladimir Putin, who was just a KGB guy at the time?
No, so the oligarchs actually found Vladimir Putin. What happened was Yeltsin got very ill. He was drunk all the time. He was having heart issues. And the oligarchs decided they needed to replace him. So they went looking for someone that they could control. And they found this low-level KGB agent, Vladimir Putin, who worked for the mayor of St. Petersburg. And Putin, they only knew him because he had helped them set up a car dealership. He was a nobody. He was someone they called a cog, some useful guy that would do whatever they said. So they plucked him out of St. Petersburg and moved him to Moscow. And very quickly, he turned the tables on them.
They say he's one of the wealthiest people on the planet. Is that true?
So, you know, nobody knows for sure how much money he has, but estimates range from $200 to $400 billion. So he would be wealthier than Elon Musk or anyone else if you could actually figure out where his money is. He's spread it out among all of these different oligarchs. He has it in all of these different investments. But yes, he's probably the most wealthy man in the world.
And if you turn on him, he turns on you in a big-time way, doesn't he?
In a big-time way. So what happened was the oligarchs placed him into power, and 1 week later he invited all of the oligarchs to Stalin's old home. And this is a place where there are bullet holes in the walls where they used to line people up. And he sat the oligarchs down at the table, and he said to them, you know, you've all made tons of money. You've all done very well. You can keep your money, but from here on out you stay out of my way. And any of the oligarchs who resisted were found hanging in their bathroom or fell down an elevator shaft or fell off a building. And the other oligarchs who went under his sway are still oligarchs today. So, yes, he can be very vicious. Anyone who stands up against him has ended up dead.
Where's that guy, Medvedev, who was his right-hand man who ran for the presidency and then stepped back when Putin came back in again?
Yeah, so he had a deal with Putin, basically, where Putin basically said, you know, you can pretend to be president, but I'm still leading the country. So there was never really a shift in power. Putin has really been in power since the mid-90s. Putin has never stepped down, and over that time, he has slowly gotten rid of anybody who caused any problems for him. So there are layers and layers of loyalists beneath Putin.
Ben, next week, Uri Geller, the mentalist, is going to be on the program, and he's telling us that he has heard that Putin is very, very ill. Are you hearing those stories?
So that's the rumor. I mean, that's been going around. You know, he doesn't look well when you see him. He looks kind of swollen, perhaps on steroids. People have said he has stomach cancer. I don't have any sort of proof or anything like that, but that has been the rumor. And, you know, he's been very isolated. He's whether it's fear of COVID, whether he has COVID, whether he has some other illness, nobody really knows for sure, but he separates himself from everyone. So it's hard to know the truth, but I'd certainly I believe it. You know, he doesn't look the same way he did even 3 years ago when you look at him.
Yeah, he looks puffy.
He does. And there are certain medicines that can cause that. And the worry is that these same medicines can cause sort of mental changes, can cause you to act aggressively. So there is a question whether or not that's involved in this.
How feared is he in Russia? And the reason I ask that, Ben, is I would have assumed by now a group of people in Russia would have gone to Putin and said, you're done. You're out. Stop this madness. That's not happening yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I've spent a lot of time with these oligarchs. You know, I hung out with them on their boats and in their bars and in the owners' boxes of soccer teams. And the truth was they were all pretty much terrified of Putin. It was the other way around. Putin was the most powerful of all the oligarchs. And so as of maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, I never would have suspected that the oligarchs could really move against Putin. But I do think in the last couple of weeks we have seen a shift. We've seen some cracks appear in that relationship. So I do think things are changing. But you have to remember, this man has been in power for a very long time and has had opportunities to get rid of anyone who stands up to him. So if you can imagine, you know, someone in 5 years getting rid of people below you, imagine if you had 30 years. So in 30 years of power, he's definitely gotten rid of most of the threats against him. And you have to also remember, he is very popular in Russia. Even though we've seen protests here and protests there, in general, he's been a very popular leader in Russia.
Prior to this episode with the Ukraine, I think this Ukraine thing could be his hanging.
Well, this is a disaster for him. And I will say this is not, he did not calculate to this point. This was not supposed to happen like this. I think he believed he'd roll right in there. It would happen very quick. Maybe the West would poo-poo and get upset, but really it would be done in a couple of days. He did not expect the entire world to rally around the Ukraine. And, you know, I've spoken to these oligarchs before about the Ukraine, and they've always said, oh, why does America even care about the Ukraine? Why does the rest of the world even care about the Ukraine? So that really was his thinking. So, yes, he's in a position that he's never expected to be in, and so I do think he is losing that popularity. But more importantly, the cracks are forming with this base of oligarchs who are very dangerous men. And they're losing a lot. These sanctions that are going up against them, you know, you can say they're hiding their money here and they're hiding money there, which is true, but they're losing their status, their respectability. They can't go to London anymore. They're losing their yachts. They're losing their planes. And they have nothing to gain. They don't love the Soviet Union. They hated the Soviet Union. The oligarchs were outsiders. They were nobodies during the Soviet Union. It was the fall of the Soviet Union that made them wealthy. So they're not on board with this invasion of Ukraine. So it's going to be really interesting to see if they can apply the pressure that's necessary to make it stop.
How could their assets be seized when technically they haven't done anything wrong?
Well, I mean, we have decided, you know, the West everywhere, Europe and the U.S., has decided that what's going on in the Ukraine is an abomination. It's disgusting, and we're going to put a stop to it however we can. And we've decided anyone who is propping up Putin is part of the problem. And so the idea is these oligarchs are known as Putin's cash register. Their money is essentially his
money. So that's why they're going after that. Stay with us, Ben. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about the situation in Russia, then we'll get into your new work, The Midnight Ride. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Ben Mesrick with us. His latest book is called The Midnight Ride, which we'll talk about in just a moment. There's a fellow by the name of Boris Berezovsky. He's dead now. He was an oligarch in the television business, wasn't he, Ben?
Yes, he was known as the godfather of the Kremlin. He actually ran pretty much all of Russia's media during the 90s. He was handed it, and then he went into oil and partnered with Roman Abramovich, who has been in the news a lot. And yes, he was found hanging in his bathroom. You know, it was never determined whether it was a suicide or a murder, but everyone who kind of knew this story knew what had happened to him.
And he was opposed to Putin, wasn't he?
Yes. So he was one of the oligarchs who was at that meeting in Stalin's house and decided he was going to go up against Putin. He felt he had put Putin into power and he could take him out. And he was basically chased out of Russia, ran to England, tried to set himself up there, and tried to sort of do a resistance movement against Putin. And then it didn't work out for him at all.
Is there a way out for Putin with this Ukraine situation?
Well, this is a great question. We need to have a way out. There needs to be an off-ramp because as he's increasingly isolated, as he's increasingly losing, he can't just say, you know, bye. He can't just lose because that'll hurt him domestically in an enormous way. So there has to be a way for him to declare a win but back out. And that's essentially what we need to happen. It worries me when people see him and say that he's just this bully we stand up to, because this is a man who has a very defined vision. He believes that the Soviet empire should come back. He believes the greatest mistake of the last century was the fall of the empire. So it's not like he's just this bully, you know, lashing out at the world. He wants to bring back the Soviet empire. And so there has to be a way for him to you know, reverse course in the Ukraine without it appearing that he has lost, at least domestically. So it's tricky. It's very tricky, unless he's replaced. But that, too, is very tricky because, as I said, he's got levels and levels of loyalty, which you have to get through.
And he seems to distance himself from people there. I mean, he sits at a table that's 20 feet long on one end.
Yes, he's been completely isolated, you know, since COVID. But even before COVID, he's been a very private, isolated man. He's a KGB guy. He's a guy who goes way back in the KGB, and he doesn't trust anyone. And everything he's doing is levels of games and levels of games. So, yes, he's very isolated. He's very separated, and he's been under threat before. And I think it's a very tricky thing to replace a man like that. On the other hand, you know, if he can be given an off-ramp and declare some sort of victory, this could definitely de-escalate.
Should we be sitting down with him saying, Vlad, what do you need?
Well, I mean, I think what he wants and what he needs is
two different
Ukraine
things.
To not ever be able to get into NATO. He wants to take the pieces of the Ukraine that he says are Russian, and then be accepted back into the world economically. But there's a lot of forces in the world that don't want that ending, so it gets very, very tricky. But yes, I hope that there's a diplomatic way out of this.
Why is he so concerned about NATO and Ukraine? Does he actually think we're going to attack him?
No, it's not that, because, you know, NATO is close to Russia in many places. It's not just the Ukraine. It really is about rebuilding the Soviet empire, and he believes the Ukraine is part of Russia. He believes a lot of all of the sort of breakaway, you know, republics that came out of the Soviet Union should be back under the sway of the Soviet Union. He doesn't mind whether it's a puppet government or whether it's part of Russia. Ukraine is no longer a puppet government for him, and that's what he wants to reinstall.
In 1990, there was a museum in Boston called Gardner Museum. It had the biggest art heist in history. You've captured that and put it into The Midnight Ride as a fiction book. Most of the time you write nonfiction, don't you?
Yeah, this is a departure for me. This is a Da Vinci Code-style thriller. It takes place in Boston, and it revolves around the greatest art heist in history and a mystery that goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War. So it mixes nonfiction and fiction, but it's really a thriller that will hopefully be a movie and a franchise of books. It's my own little Da Vinci Code, so I'm hoping people buy it because I'd love to be writing these for years to come.
What actually happened, Ben, with the heist?
Well, this is a really amazing story. So in 1990, in the middle of the night, it was on St. Patrick's Day, two men posing as police officers knocked on the side door of the Gardner Museum in Boston. A security guard let them in. They tied up the security guard and another security guard, and they made off with 11 paintings worth now about $1 billion, as well as a couple items that don't really make any sense. And they stole these 13 items, got away, and they've never been seen since. And there's a $10 million reward for anyone with any information about these paintings. It's the largest unsolved art heist in history.
Isn't that unusual, the fact that all these years have gone by and they haven't popped up yet?
It's spectacularly unusual. There is no other heist like it where this many super famous paintings have just vanished. And they're so famous that you couldn't sell them. They can't be fenced. They can't be, you know, if they're ever shown, someone will know who they what they are. So it is very odd and very unique.
Strange stuff. And tell us how you illustrated it in the book, The Midnight Ride.
Yeah, well, I want to tell you how I got into the story, because this is even odder. So about 15 years ago, I got a phone call in the middle of the night from a guy. So as a writer, I get calls all the time from people pitching stories. He claimed to have been one of the people who robbed the Gardner Museum. He called me a little after midnight, and he wanted to meet with me. And he told me some things that made me think he wasn't just, you know, lying. He told me things that have come out since. He had just gotten out of prison for a very similar crime, and he told me some details that, you know, made me think that he was telling the truth. And then he wanted to meet me. He set up a meeting in an alley in South Boston.
Oh, right. You'd go there, right?
Right, and he said I had to come alone. And so as a journalist, I started to get nervous. You know,
sure.
You have that sense. And so I tried to sort of shift where we would meet, and he got agitated. He hung up on me, and I never heard from him again. So for the past 15 years, I've always wondered and regretted and thought to myself, could I have broken this huge art heist? Could I have actually seen the paintings? And so when I had the opportunity to write a thriller, I wanted to go back to that. So what happens in this book in the first chapter is how I believe the art heist actually happened based on what this guy told me. And he told me things that were pretty amazing, that the heist was concocted by a very wealthy man who had ordered it. He had paid these criminals to rob the museum because he wanted a specific item from the museum. But that rich person died before they could deliver the painting. And that's the reason the paintings ended up in limbo, because you can't sell them, but the guy who was paying for them died and never paid for them. So these robbers basically had this art and couldn't do anything with it.
Are there people that have so much money that they have this kind of artwork tucked away somewhere in their house?
Yes, and this goes back to Russian oligarchs. I've seen stolen artwork. I've been to sort of billionaires' homes, and they have something called vaults in the basement and where they keep artwork that you don't know where it comes from. And so this is actually fairly common in major heists that someone would pay for it. So there's about three reasons why people rob museums of famous art. One of them is they're paid to order by some very wealthy person. One of them is they use it as insurance. If they get thrown in jail, you can return a painting and get out of jail free. And that happens a lot. And then the third way is between drug dealers or between mobsters, you can have a piece of art insure a deal. And so those are really the three main reasons that art like that famous is stolen.
What made you write it as a fiction as opposed to a nonfiction book?
Well, the Midnight Ride actually came about because a year ago, in the midst of sort of the worst part of the pandemic, the Boston Globe had called me up out of the blue. They wanted to do something that was kind of old is new again and actually do a serialized book in the pages of the newspaper. So I actually wrote this one chapter a day for 3 weeks. You know, I was handing in chapters right before it would go to print, and it was running on the cover of the Boston Globe for 3 weeks. And it built this very, very large audience. By the end, there was, you know, 100,000 readers. And I started getting calls from my agent in Hollywood. I hadn't told anyone I was doing this because I was doing it for free, just for the city of Boston, because I'm a Boston guy and I wanted to sort of just do something fun. And my agent was like, are you doing something in the Globe? Because we're getting all these offers. And that's when Steven Spielberg bought the rights to do a movie. So suddenly it became this much bigger project. So it really was just a way to stop thinking about COVID because, you know, it was just all in the news. That's all anyone was talking about. So I wrote this thriller that I'd always wanted to write. I've always wanted to be Michael Crichton or Dan Brown and write a book like that. And that's how it happened. And then I've grown. What I wrote for The Globe was about 20,000 words, and the book is now 80,000 words, and it's a full-size thriller. So it was just one of the most wonderful writing experiences of my career.
When do you think it'll hit the big screen?
You know, we're working on it now. I just finished the screenplay for it and handed it in. And so I hope to shoot the movie over the next year. But the book really just came out now, so we'll see. I'm writing the sequel right now, which will come out next year. So if people enjoy this one, they'll get a second one next year. So it's been kind of a blast.
You're one of the most successful authors, Ben, whose books turn into movies. It's truly remarkable.
You know, it's been amazing. The Social Network was just one of those movies that sort of everybody saw, and since then I've been able to sort of go right to Hollywood with my projects, and I have a movie being developed right now called The Anti-Social Network, which was about that GameStop drama, and that movie is actually shooting this summer, and then I have Bitcoin Billionaires about the whole Bitcoin revolution also shooting this summer. So hopefully next year there'll be three of my movies coming out. So yeah, it's been a really fortunate, lucky career for me.
And the movie 21 was fun. That was a great movie.
Yeah, that movie's exploding on Netflix now. It's actually the number 7 most streamed current movie right now on all of Netflix. It was a fun movie about these card counters who took Vegas for millions, a group of kids using math. True story, who were able to beat the casinos and won about $6 million playing blackjack.
It was with Kevin Spacey, too. Great actor, and it's so sad that he's involved in that situation he's involved in now.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Kevin
he's great actor.
Was one of the greatest actors of all time. There's no question about that. But, you know, he's someone we don't really talk about much anymore. Whether the world will let him have a comeback or not, it's hard to say, but he really was a phenomenal actor, and you know, in the early part of my career, that movie was a big movie. It was the number one movie for a while, and it was just a wild experience being involved with it.
I think people would accept him if he went and got some help. What do you think?
I mean, I think that is the way to redemption for all of these guys. You know, when people fall off the beaten path and do some bad things, they need to apologize and seek restitution and seek help. Kevin definitely had some issues. There's no question about that. He was a troubled person who you know, apparently did some bad things, and it's unfortunate because there's no question about his talent, you know, and it's really hard to separate the talent from the person. And we've seen this again and again where these truly talented people have demons, you know, and you wonder, does it mean you can't enjoy their work? Does it mean you shouldn't ever come back? They should be finished forever? Or do you at some point, you know, let them move on?
I like him in the movie he financed, Beyond the Sea, where he played the part of Bobby Darin. He did a good job on that, too.
Yeah, that was a smaller movie. A lot of people didn't see that movie, but it was, I mean, he's just an incredibly talented person. There's, you know, the Usual Suspects was just incredible. I mean, he's done some wonderful work.
Absolutely. Now you have another card shark in this book, The Midnight Ride.
Yeah, so Bringing Down the House came out 20 years ago. It's kind of amazing. It's been my 20-year anniversary for that book. And so this book, the main character is a card counter, just like in Bringing Down the House. It's a young woman named Haley Gordon, who is at the Encore Casino in Boston, you know, winning, and then suddenly she's getting chased by the casino goons, which is what happens when you win too much at a casino. And she finds something that leads her into this mystery that goes all the way back to the Revolutionary Era.
That's amazing. And you're happy with The Midnight Ride? It's out now. I've got a copy in my hand.
Yeah, it just came out. It's been really, really cool. We've actually been doing this cool kind of virtual book club. I have an NFT project. I don't know if you're into the whole NFT world, but there's a Ben Mezrich NFT project involved around the Midnight Ride. So we've got this virtual club that uses NFTs to sort of gather together solving a puzzle related to the book. So it's been really a blast. The book just came out, and it's you know, having a book come out during a war and a pandemic is never the best timing to get the kind of press that you want. But it's really been a blast because it's just a project that I've always wanted to do. And so I'm just hoping people pick up The Midnight Ride and allow me to write many more of these.
We're going to take calls next hour with Ben. We can talk about Russian oligarchs. We can talk about this heist that occurred in 1990. It's just amazing. It's been that long, and none of this artwork has shown up, has it?
No, and you know, most of the people involved are dead. So a lot of the criminals that they had as sort of suspects died in very, very violent ways. You know, one was found sort of slashed and beaten in the trunk of his car. You know, a lot of these people were toughs in Boston. They were mobsters. And this was a very violent time in Boston in the 90s, where you had Whitey Bulger and all of these people essentially killing each other. So that's part of the reason, is most of the people who were involved are probably dead. But it is strange. You know, some of these paintings are worth, and the reward of $10 million, you would think someone would come forward if they saw it in an attic, right? These paintings are out there.
Well, the paintings were of, who were the artists?
There were a number of very famous artists, and the most famous painting was the Sea of Galilee, the storm on the Sea of Galilee. And it just escaped my brain of who the artist was. I believe there was a Rembrandt. Yes, there was a Rembrandt in there. Yeah, Rembrandt did the Storm on the Sea of Galilee, and that was the most famous one of them all. It was a number of Dutch painters that were stolen from the Dutch room in the Gardner that were the most expensive of them.
How did they get the paintings out, Ben?
So they rolled them up. So what's interesting is they planned out getting into the building, but they were very amateurish in what they did. You know, they smashed the glass frames, they rolled them up, they cut them with razor blades, rolled them out, and then carried them out, but they didn't even have tubes to put them in. So it was really strange, and they did disable the cameras. You know, this was back in 1990, so it was all cassette tapes.
Yeah.
So they took the tapes out and got rid of them. But they spent almost 2 hours in the museum, which is insane for a heist like this. They obviously weren't afraid of police showing up, and part of that was because it was St. Patrick's Day in Boston. And if you've ever been to Boston on St. Patty's Day,
yeah.
Any police that are there who are not drunk are dealing with drunks. It was a good night to do a robbery, but very strange crime. They didn't kill the guards. They left them tied up in the basement. And it was just very unprofessional in certain aspects. But the really weird part, and what my book is about, is these two items that weren't the paintings that were stolen. Because they weren't worth anything, but they were hard to steal.
Let's talk about those things next when we come back and take calls too.